Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been an advocate for people with autism since her son Nat, now in his mid-20s, was first diagnosed at age 3. In addition to her advocacy, Susan Senator has shared everything she's learned along the way about caring for a child on the autism spectrum in her books Making Peace with Autism and The Autism Mom's Survival Guide. But her latest book focuses on one of the deepest fears for any parent of a child with disabilities: how to ensure that your child will have as fulfilling and independent adult life as possible, and one that will continue on after the parents are gone. Her book, Autism Adulthood: Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life, shares her own story of negotiating vocational training and independent living for her son and those of 30 other parents, autistic adults, caregivers, researchers, and professionals. It can be complicated and incredibly challenging, but families are finding a variety of solutions, each tailored to the realities of their child or family member with autism. The name of the book is Autism Adulthood. Susan Senator is an author, an advocate for people with autism, and our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Susan Senator, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This new book that you've written, while it's written for families of people with autism, really speaks to any family with a child with a significant disability, because it speaks to how parents launch that child into their adulthood, hopefully an independent adulthood, and how to give that child the skills to survive and ultimately thrive beyond the parents' lives. Was that the point of the book?
Sure. I was feeling like I first needed to learn, you know, how to transition my son into adulthood. And then as I was learning, I realized, well, the stuff I've learned is probably going to help other people as well, because it's just not obvious. You know, not only was I learning on my own process, but talking to people who are there or have been there, you know, the older parents, gave me some really good strategies and ideas.
Tell us a little bit about your family. Your son, Nat, now is well into his 20s, right?
Yeah, he's 26. He has limited communication, but I think he can understand more of what's going on around him. And until recently, he had a part-time job at a supermarket and was living in an apartment nearby with a caregiver. And now his situation is different, has changed, and we're really trying to plan the next phase for him.
Yeah. But the book was set up to sort of help negotiate that transition into adulthood from a situation where you as parents, you as a family, your family, have been really responsible for a lot of Nat's care, into independent living. Can you describe that long pathway of getting Nat to that point?
I think that what helped get him ready for adulthood, more or less, is the fact that we had him go away sometimes to sleepaway camp for kids with autism. We got him used to sometimes staying with my parents. And then when he was 17, he actually went to the residence at his school. And even though that was a horribly hard decision for us, it ended up being another one of these experiences that taught him how to live away from home. I just think that's a tremendous skill that people can try to foster, you know, as soon as they feel that they and their child is ready.
And you mentioned Nat has significant communication difficulties, and he had many episodes of aggression, and there were other issues with your other children from just dealing with the aggressiveness of Nat at various points during his growing up years, correct?
Yeah, the aggression, I mean, we've come to learn is, like any other behavior you might encounter with autism, it's really a form of communication. It's like, you know, Nat was trying to tell us something and was just completely frustrated. This is not to excuse anything he did that hurt us. But I understand that communication was just central to his inability to calm down. And it wasn't until we found modes of communicating with him that he was able to understand more of how the world works, and really express what was going on inside him and regulate his surroundings a little bit better.
So I wanted to preface that, because when you say, well, we've tried to send him to day camps and things like that, and I can hear some parents just saying, wow, I don't think we could ever do that with our child. How difficult a decision was that to embark on that from a pretty early age?
the day camp thing didn't really happen until he was 17.
Okay.
But he did stay with my parents at times, and I feel like that was the beginning of getting him just used to the concept that he can be taken care of and communicate with other people other than us. And so I think that, you know, the other step of the camps, for instance, you know, that comes up kind of when you're ready and when you're looking around. And really, it's the other parents who come through in this way. I learned about our particular camp through a few friends who'd sent their kids there. And so if these are families that I trust, whose children have similar challenges to Nat, then I have a pretty good place to start in figuring out if that's a good place to send them or not. I trust the parents and then do my homework.
One of the things that you relate in the book was that even in his middle teens, maybe, you were already starting to think about adulthood, the year age 22, which at that point was, what is the importance of age 22 first?
At age 22 in Massachusetts is when public education system ends for people with disabilities, and they enter the adult service system, which is very different because there's no mandated services like there are in, you know, in school.
Right.
And in other states, it's different age. Some are still 22, but some are 21, some even 26. But still, families have to know what that age is and take a few years before it comes to think ahead and make some plans.
You were thinking about it much earlier than that. And really, one of the sort of roadblocks you ran into was that the system was saying, oh, you have plenty of time to figure that out. And you were wanting to figure it out now.
That's partly my personality, is that I want to figure it out now. And, you know, I can't stand not knowing something that I need to know. But I think a lot of special needs parents feel that way because of the experience that they've gone through, just having to figure things out on the fly or learning very quickly or the hard way that this was the wrong placement or this was the wrong approach. You know, so already you have that feeling of a fire lit under you that you need to act for those future years, especially when there aren't services just like out there waiting. Plus the fact that the school systems might not actually tell you when it's time to start thinking in terms of vocational training your kids should maybe get, or how to look for colleges that have special supports for people with autism and disabilities. The school systems might not be aware of that stuff. So that's another reason that parents have to think earlier and why I did.
It seems like the one of the key situations in Nat's life was that pretty early on, you and your husband basically said, we're going to send him on a vocational path as opposed to trying to go to college or an academic sort of approach. You chose a vocational approach, one that seemed to make him a little more independent.
I think that choosing vocational and independent living skills was the key for Nat, because we could see that we really had to make some tough choices. Were we going to spend all of these precious years of public education support and services on trying to get him to understand history and science, or were we going to just take what we could of the rest of the school years and get him to be as independent as possible so that we wouldn't have to worry, you know, completely worry about how is he going to live as an adult. I think that even kids going on to college can benefit from that kind of thinking, though, from independent living training, you know, self-care, cooking for yourself, you know, running a household, as well as some kind of job experience. It's bound to help no matter who you are. But especially for our guys on the spectrum with a tremendous unemployment rate, just the more training you have ahead of time, the better.
Was that a difficult decision to make at the time? Because I sense that both you and your husband are college educated, and probably your other kids are college material. Was that a difficult decision at the time to give up on sort of a college education for Nat?
Yeah, I was so sad to realize that, I mean, not only college, but, you know, just even academics in general. I know other families don't make that kind of decision, but we were really sad about it. But on the other hand, it was just based on, like, the sense of reality. Like, I really see him as someone who needs to be as self-sufficient as possible. So that was the comfort I took from it, you know. But yeah, it was really hard feeling like we were at a crossroads and we were making this choice for him. And how did we know that we would be right, you know?
It comes across in the pages, that sort of difficulty in making that decision. But you did get with a vocational specialist who seemed to be very helpful and was looking at what vocational skills Nat did have and the amount of work he was doing, which because he was at a school where they were doing some work. And that vocational specialist says, we've got to ramp this up. I mean, he's got to be able to work within a few years, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, when we were at our team meeting, our liaison from the state agency, the Department of Developmental Services, was really a sharp woman, and she talked to the school people about how Nat was showing that he really could work. He was making boxes at a pizza place, and he was really productive, like incredibly productive, like piles of pizza boxes in front of him that he made. You know, to demonstrate to the team and, you know, for the state to realize that Nat really could benefit from having job support as an adult. So we were building the case, basically, for funding him for a job coach and maybe transportation to a job so that he'd be able to continue with that kind of activity.
My guest today is Susan Senator, a writer, mother, advocate for people with autism. Her previous book, Making Peace with Autism, her new book is titled Autism Adulthood, Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. And it's talking about this transition for families with people with autism and making that adjustment to adulthood and all the decisions that have to go into it, because it is vocational training. It's all sorts of other things going into it. You know, we always hear about people with autism having some special passion, and you know, sometimes it works out into a great vocation or occupation. Has that been the case with Nat, or what is his special passion?
Well, we're trying to figure that out with him.
Still. Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's not true that there's any sort of like
sure.
genius skill, but definitely people with autism, like everyone else, will have passions and hobbies and areas of focus, but with communication and social challenges, it's really hard for them to maybe figure that out. So I've been just trying to be a detective with Nat to sort of jump on whatever I see as an affinity for something or an enjoyment of something. And for us, it's been, for him, for a while, it's been sports through Special Olympics. And recently we found out about a band of people with autism who were looking for a drummer, and he has started playing with them and learning how to do that. That's a whole new area for him.
Wow, that's great. Well, so once you found the vocational piece of the puzzle, and I assume that is ongoing, does that go through adulthood as well, vocational training?
Oh, sure. If you're lucky and you know to push for it. I mean, these days there are internships. Like there's a fabulous teaching hotel, a Marriott in Muncie, in Indiana. And there's also programs at community colleges now that can help people, you know, learn about cooking and hospitality, hospital skills. You know, so you can still keep your education going, but you just have to know to look for it and ask for it. And in Nat's case, he gets on-the-job training, certainly, for whatever new job he might have.
Yeah. Now, how difficult is it to negotiate all of these agencies, you know, vocational, residential? And you mentioned, it said you have to know to ask for it. How much is in your experience, how much has the state helped, and how much is it your ability to understand what's going on and to ask for the help that your son needs?
Well, I think that the state, you know, it is kind of apparent. You know, it'll be different person to person. But I think that if a parent or self advocate goes into the process knowing that nobody's going to offer you anything, it's not out of evil or malice. It's really about budgets and large caseloads. So if you just go in knowing what your needs and vision might be, you know, then you can ask, and you're coming from a position of negotiating and asking and telling the people at the meeting, you know, what you might need, and take it from there. You know, then it becomes a conversation. Like, they might say, no, we don't do that. I recommend pushing back and saying, well, there might be a way that you can do that. You know, so to be strong and clear in what you want and also what your compromises could be.
Have you found that you've had to push back and sort of overcome an initial denial to get services for your son?
Absolutely. You know, our very first state liaison told us that, you know, we couldn't try to put together a group home for Nat. And, you know, I had a conversation with a mentor who told me, yes, you really can. There's something called self-direction. And, you know, where the family and the self-advocate determine for themselves how the funding can be used to support his vision and his life. So I knew that we could probably work with the state to put together a new group home instead of having them put Nat in an opening that was already there. I didn't want him to just be, you know, slotted in. You know, I really wanted to have a hand in it. And I was told no, but ultimately we did win in that one. And it wasn't a terrible struggle. It was, you know, nothing I hadn't encountered in the school years, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, it sounds from the book like that's been the most challenging part, is finding independent housing for your son. And you, it seems like you've been through a number of settings. Can you maybe talk about the spectrum of settings for adults with autism, as far as there's group homes, there's all sorts of things in between?
Yeah, there's... people think of group homes and they think even of institutions which have or are closing down all over the country, so that more and more there's opportunities to live in the community in one way or another. And so that might be living, it might be living with your parents, but with support. There's loans, at least in my state, low interest loans for building on, like, accessory apartments. And you can possibly, find an inexpensive apartment and also try to recruit a caregiver to live with your autistic loved one. That's called shared living. There's also a program called adult family care, where you might find a family who wants to have someone interesting and who will actually bring, you know, a small stipend, you know, that they can add to their family life. There's special people out there who want to do stuff like that. But, you know, seriously, it's hard to find them. It's really hard.
Yeah. Now, how many different home settings has Nat been in since he left your home?
He's been in a shared living kind of situation. So,
was that like about four guys with autism?
Yeah, that was like three or four, and a live-in caregiver, and then a support person who came every now and then to help them out. Then they had a temporary group home while we looked for a permanent group home. And then eventually we felt that my son could do better in an apartment with a caregiver instead of a group home. We wanted him to have more of a even more normal life. So he moved to an apartment with the caregiver, and he was in that arrangement for 2 years. So he's had about four placements in almost 5 years.
Mm-hmm. How does he react to the changing situations? Is he pretty flexible in that?
Well, we try to really involve him in the changes, you know. So I did my best to ask him many times and in many different ways, do you want to leave Grove Street? That was where the home was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to have to move into an apartment? And you know, ask it in all these different ways to see if I could get him to give me an answer. So once I had the answer, I could work with him and say things like, well, new home in the fall, you know, moving out in the summer. You know, I could just give him a calendar to look at, so that it wouldn't be too hard. But, you know, it's still a big deal. And I think he gets really quiet and very still when he's moving into a new situation and just trying to regroup. I've come to learn that that's how he expresses it as opposed to kind of acting out.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was interesting, you were in the, you relate in the book how you were trying to determine if he wanted it. It was a matter of asking in a whole different ways. And he would say apartment. I guess that's how he would say he wanted to live in the apartment. And I guess that's sort of what he grew up with. You guys have lived in an apartment for a good part of your life?
Yeah, we were in condos and mm-hmm. eventually a house, but always in a city. We're in an urban part, an urban neighborhood of Boston. So he grew up in, you know, close quarters to other neighbors and taking a lot of walks to places and using public transportation. So I think to him, apartment versus house, you know, meant what he'd grown up with. And even now that he's out of the apartment, right now he's saying that he wants to sleep at home. So he's telling me that he wants to be here for a bit, and until we figure out what's next. And, you know, that I take it very seriously that, you know, I'm going to have to work out respite and try to find help taking care of him while he's living here, and still look for a placement for him outside eventually, because I think that's better for him, and it's better for us.
Yeah. Now the book talks about all the questions you need to be asking of caregivers. What are some of the things you need to know going into this situation?
I feel like with caregivers, I'm learning more and more as I go. I think that it's really best to take a long time to get to know the person before you set up the living situation. You know, just really, you get to know this person and learn what they're like, and they get to know your loved one and you, and really get I need for them to have a sense of all the issues that Nat presents so that they understand the worst-case scenario. They understand the extent of his disability. And that, I think that would take months, frankly. So I would go really slow from now on before, you know, finding a caregiver.
Yeah. I was also struck by the section you wrote about your family. One of the things, as you as a parent age, are the siblings going to have to help with the care for Nat? And that's something... this has been a very big question in your life.
Yeah, I've always wanted my other two sons, who are younger than Nat, to have their own lives and to never feel like they came into this earth to be Nat's caregivers. On the other hand, I want them to have a relationship with him, and so that's taken years to evolve for both of them. And only recently have I begun to say to them, we're working things out so that, you know, you guys would not be hands-on caregivers for Nat unless you wanted that. But you're going to have some kind of decision-making responsibility in his life. That is the reality. But I'm also always looking for other people who would help them out even with that.
And what's that process been like? I mean, what sounds like was at times a very difficult relationship growing up have come to accept Nat and to decide to be a part of his life at some point when they're needed to step in.
Yeah, I feel that as they get older, they definitely have more of an ability to accept Nat's quirks and differences and challenges and to figure out how to directly communicate with him. I think it can be scary for them because it's just very different talking to someone who has very few words. And, you know, they have also lately been able to stay with Nat for short periods of time if we couldn't. And that was a huge milestone, especially for my youngest, to suddenly be in charge of his brother who's 8 years older than him. But Ben is now 18 and felt okay about it. So once we saw that he felt safe doing that, we left them for a few hours, and it worked out great. And it's given Ben this whole new sense of of what his brother's like and what, you know, perhaps what the possibilities are for them to have a relationship.
Well, you mentioned that Nat's not working right now, but he has worked in the past. And I was really struck by one of the experts you write about in the book. And I should mention the book mentions a whole lot of families and a whole lot of different situations, from rural settings for adults with autism to a situation more like Nat, where you're living right in the heart of the city. And I was struck by this expert who said, you know, we focus so much on the downside of autism, what a horrible disability it is, but at the same time, we say, well, this person with autism can work for you, and it's not surprising that the world at large is confused by autism. What was your reaction to that thought?
That was Peter Gerhardt, and that's exactly how I feel about it, too. Like, there's just such a dichotomy between how people are presented with a picture of autism, always as this huge tragedy and nothing else, versus what these people are capable of just given the right education and supports. And even, like, they may have an extra talent for certain kinds of employment because of their profound ability to focus and not need any extra chit-chat or days off, you know. there's such advantages, but really we aren't hearing a lot about that because it's just not as interesting a story in the media. I just think that I would really like to continue to add to the knowledge of the positive aspects of working and living with someone with autism and how it's really possible to connect even if they're so different from you.
Is that probably the biggest issue is you know, having an adulthood where you have this feeling of usefulness, of having a job, of contributing in some way? How important do you think that is to the population?
I just imagine that, you know, people with autism are, you know, all different the way anyone without autism might be from another. But in general, I think that we all, as people, want to be occupied with stuff that fascinates us and that makes us happy. And often I think that adults really get reward from working. And also, actually, the ability to pay for things that you want that might not necessarily come with just the government funding, you know. So there's just so much that I think that we all feel about being out there in the world and working, and there's no reason, for the most part, why people with autism can't.
Yeah. Well, the book is an excellent resource guide for families with an autistic family member making that jump to adulthood. Autism, Adulthood, Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. Susan Senator, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Susan Senator is a writer and advocate for people with autism and the author of Autism, Adulthood, Strategies and Insights for a Fulfilling Life. It's published by Skyhorse. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.